Now, let me ask you, as we open up this second part of the course for the evening, am I being clear? Mr. Fierce, you're the new member of the course. The others have been with me, and they have obviously a better background. Have I brought you into the swing of thinking? Am I clear enough for you? As a background, you might want to read the first part of the textbook, and probably Defense of Faith, Van Til's book, which we use in the morning course, to which you're incidentally welcome. That's the basic course, and this is really the advanced course in apologetics. Some student might say there's no difference between them. Armand, would that be your opinion?
Oh, it is definitely.
You're a little late on the uptake, that's why I wondered. What about you? The object of the course is to strengthen your Christian faith and to allow you to see the nature of the opposition which we face in the intellectual circle and the cultural circles in general. This is not a dilettante course. It's not a course where we're trying to show off our knowledge or lack thereof, but to apply the Word of God and its richness and fullness and its glory to meeting the needs of the Christian as he deals with a non-Christian, as he seeks to defend the faith, as he seeks to live the faith, as he seeks to understand the world in which you and I live. We do not live in ivory towers or ivy-colored walls behind which we engage in intellectual speculation, as did the medieval monks, at least were accused of it, but we do it as thinking beings, as those who are called upon to think the thoughts of Jesus Christ after him. And this is our high calling in Christ. Today in Greek class, we were discussing First Corinthians 2, 9, 10, 11, 12, and 13. They testified we had tremendous exegetical discussion on the mind of Christ, which I thought was exhilarating. Didn't you, Dick? Dick is a surviving member of that class who is here tonight. The others are not in this course. And that is a different problem, that course. It's exegesis. Having had Greek New Testament, Machen's grammar, we now go into the exegesis of the word. I trust that I shall soon see some of you in that course. After you've had Machen or Davis and a combination thereof, it's a marvelous experience. I love it. Now, having said that as a kind of introduction, making sure that we're all together, in our thinking, at least I don't mean we necessarily agree with me, I mean we're at the same point, is what I'm trying to say. Let's go to Lester Frank Ward. Yes, Arma. Please do.
I was wondering if you could on page 140.
Yes.
There's a few statements about a paragraph here on page 140. In that little bitty print right above it.
Yes. This is pathetically interesting. I got this out of A.G. Keller, who collected all of William Graham Sumner's available statements concerning life and so on, which he could find. He was a devotee of Sumner, and yet he had something to see that. If you read that long paragraph at the top of 140, you will see, note the first sentence, the great stream of time and earthly things will sweep on in spite of it. It bears with it now all the errors and follies of the past, the wreckage of all the philosophies, the fragments of all the civilization, the wisdom of all the abandoned ethical systems, the debris of all the institutions, the penalties of all the mistakes. It is only in imagination that we stand by and look and criticize and plan to change it. He said, you cannot change society. Every one of us, a child of his age, and cannot get out of it. It will swallow both us and our experiments. It will absorb the efforts of change and will take them into itself as but trivial components. And the great movement of tradition and work will go on unchallenged by our fads and schemes. You cannot change the evolutionary process. And they said, men will be carried along as tides are relentlessly carried along many, many people as they swept down the Mississippi Valley or out in California, as you know in this recent tidal experience. And then said he, and he wrote this in 1910, I have lived through the best period of this country's history. The next generations are going to see war and social calamities. I am glad I do not have to live on into it. Now, this is curious in that if you will think back, and some of us may, for years, economists and social writers in general regarded the era of 1900 to 1914 as the era of normalcy. And they measured all succeeding eras in terms of that normalcy. If you had been living in the 1930s and early 40s, they would have measured the economic prosperity by the index of 1900-1914. This was the era of almost unbelievable optimism. In 1912, in the election that year, the Outlook magazine insisted that in every day there looks a better tomorrow. That we are looking forward to a time when there shall be no more war. And the editor was Theodore Roosevelt. Well, he was a co-editor. And with the advance with the election of Wilson, there was a short period of optimism, which is for you and for me, is almost impossible that men believe it. And yet, at his death, or just before his death, William Graham Sumner saw what he regarded as the inevitable result of the evolutionary philosophy which he held.
Do you remember his date?
1840. I think from 1910.
1840?
I think it is. I'll have to check that. I should have put that in this book, and I don't know why I didn't. Now, Lester Frank was almost, he is contemporary with Sumner. But notice how different. Now, Ward was as much an evolutionist as was Sumner. However, he objected to the tremendous pessimism, to the hopelessness of this ironclad dependence on natural law, which characterized Sumner. And so, although he was the champion of evolutionary thought in social practice, he took the other aspect of Darwin, namely the transmission of acquired characteristics. And this he was very much like Spencer. Ward relied on Darwin, particularly the transmission of acquired characteristics. And he is the first real American sociologist. He wrote Dynamic Sociology. He wrote a string of books in the 1890s. I had them here somewhere in one of these pages. Now, he made a concession to mine, which Sumner did not make. He believed that man can achieve certain characteristics in any age and can transmit them. He believed that in the upper echelons of the evolutionary struggle, mind becomes more important. So, remember, see, low cunning and animal sagacity, though very prominent, were more and more supplanted by the more refined and subtle manifestations of the same psychic principle. And it's been accelerated. So he thought that man, that society, can obtain desirable characteristics. But how does he do it? He will do it through science. Then up at the top of 143, I would direct your attention rather closely to this. In the realm of actual world politics, and note this, Ward called for the establishment of sociocracy. I'll tell you the reason he's saying. When I wrote my theological interpretation of American thought, I devoted some pages to Ward, and I used the phrase sociocracy. And when the editors were having the final typeset, they called me one day in panic on the phone and said, did you make that word up? I said, we can't find any dictionary, and they didn't think it existed. I said, no. I said, I got off at Lester Frank Ward. And that satisfied them. But he coined the word. But it shook them, and they thought I was making mistakes. He coined the word to denote the type of government which he wanted for this country. And it was a sociocracy. Now, what is a sociocracy? It is a government ruled, krateo in Greek, the bureaucracy is there, by sociologists or sociocrats. They were to be highly trained sociologists. Now, what would be the function of this government? Well, obviously, first one, in his scheme, only Darwinian sociologists could hold office. And there would be no elected Congress. But what would there be? How do you do, sir? Can I help you? Okay. You're welcome. There would only be sociocrats. There would be no Congress, no Senate, no House. Some people think today it wouldn't be too bad. Sociologists in their training would conduct the government, and they would address themselves to disease, to ignorance, to poverty, to inequality, and such like. And these new statesmen would, by a magic touch, eliminate these from the American scene, and they would produce ultimately a secularized Garden of Eden, in which somehow or other even labor would become pleasant. Now, I don't have it. I thought I had. Yes, I do. Down at the bottom of the next page. But let me give it to you here. War gave to sociology a much greater importance in his insistence that its self-discipline must enter the social and much political and economic life of the nation. And that is very... You see, Sumner had a tremendous influence in his day. But after 1914, Sumner's influence began to wear thin, only had a place in those areas, in those people who had been trained by him, but whose number began to diminish as the 20th century wore on. So that by 1933-34, under Franklin Roosevelt, the Sumnerian concept was pretty much a thing of the past. On the other hand, Ward came to his own. Now, Ward openly wanted a dictatorship, a totalitarian state, which there would be no constitution. But that's not the end of the story. I might say, I don't want to ask a personal question, but Mr. Fierce, do you remember Harry Hopkins? He was an out-and-out advocate of Lester Frank Ward. And it was he who sold Roosevelt on the whole idea of the welfare state, which is Ward. Now, in the eyes of many people, Ward offered the ideal solution to a rampant and unbridled laissez-faire. And in his solution, having created the sociocracy, now let's look at 144, Ward was much more hostile to evangelical Christianity than was Sumner. Sumner never lost entirely, at least a polite acquiescence in the Episcopal Church. Not that he was ardently for it, but he didn't go ranting and raving around. He went to Sunday services and then wrote anti-Christian material the rest of the week. Ward was much more consistent. He didn't go to Sunday service and he wrote anti-Christian literature. He was violently against the Constitution, against American heritage. And very basically, students, this is what he called for. He called for the establishment of government dormitories in which the children of the nation would be brought up. As I remember, the ages were from 3 to 18. Now, these government dormitories would be run by sociocrats, who would actually have the training and the rearing of the young people, and they would become, quote, good citizens, unquote, the type of citizen which the sociocrats desire in order to accomplish their aims. That is, to accomplish these acquired characteristics equality, no disease, no war, no poverty, no nothing. Now, these were dormitory schools, which he intended to put up. He also advocated the end of marriage. Children would be produced by cohabiting couples who would be together for a period of 5 years. In other words, he said marriage is the worst enemy that women have. Marriage is a method by which women have been enslaved. And the family simply continues that slavery. And he was the original ERA-er. His concept was that women should be freed from any feminine duties and should be, after 5 years, free to cohabit with any man they might desire. Cohabitation was strictly for the purpose of producing children for the state, but no idea of parental training, no idea of a loving situation, no idea of a permanent union between one man, one woman. Now, obviously, underneath this, and he said this, that he had contempt for Christianity. That and this he borrowed a great deal from Marx. Christianity is a religion which enslaves women. But like Marx, he never could answer the basic question: why do women love to be enslaved? Now, I'm not trying to be funny here. I'm funny. I mean, let's face
it.
Well, I know she says she doesn't like to be. I want to talk to these liberated women when they're 55 and 60 and 65.
Well, you might not have to wait that long to get a picture of one of them on the U.S. News or whatever.
I know, yeah.
And see what you have.
No. Their liberation is a mirage.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yes, they did.
Almost like saying, ERA, you're winning now.
The results are coming home. Well, he was violently anti-Christian. He regarded Christianity as a figment of man's imagination by which men, the priest class, enslaved the rest of men and women. But here again, if the so-called priestly class has done this, and by their own acknowledgement they have been able to do it through the centuries, what is there in the rest of the population which makes them unswervingly, as they said, look to a priestly class who defrauds them and who misleads them? In other words, why has this mirage of religion continued if it is so very, very erroneous? And of course, Marx never answered this question, neither did Lester Frank Ward. But he would create a new society, a society dedicated to a totalitarian regime. Now, let me point out to you, we have come to the end of the course. There is a man writing today who's a professor of psychiatry at Harvard who is basically a Frank Ward man. Do you know who he is? B.F. Skinner. Yes. And in Walden 2 and Beyond Freedom and Dignity, he outlines a program for American society which is strangely much like that of Lester Frank Ward. He does more of Freudian psychology than Ward does, because Ward didn't know Freud. But he's essentially a Ward in his political and social economic outlook. How many have ever read Walden 2? For college, or have you read it since? Well, do you not agree with me? It's not great literature. But it is important because of the very, very dangerous philosophy which underlies it, and which he openly expresses. See, in his Walden society, young men and young women live together, no marriage. Oh, he wouldn't, he has one, remember this Rusty where he says one place he wouldn't oppose marriage if somebody wanted to do it, but it was something he certainly doesn't encourage, because it has a debasing quality about it. And so obviously there's no thought that illegitimacy is any problem. because every offspring is a love, is a product of an ethical situation in which love predominates, at least for a few minutes. Now, unlike Sumner, Ward lived, well, he didn't live many longer. Well, he did a couple, 1913. But through his students, he taught at Brown University. And I might add that Brown University has a Lester Frank Ward library with all his writings in it, dedicated to perpetuation not only of his memory, but of his influence. Now, you see, Ward was a covenant breaker, and he wanted men to be covenant breakers. He denied the God of the Old Covenant, the God of the New Covenant. He threw off the shackles of biblical revelation. He threw off the shackles of thus saith the Lord. He threw off the shackles of Ten Commandments. He threw off the shackles of anything biblical, and thus plunged sociology into the abyss of irrationalism. You see my point here, Rusty? I'm not just shooting off at sociology. I wouldn't have you think that I were, just for the fun of discomfiting a student. I don't do it. I don't do it without sufficient evidence. John, do you have any questions?
Not right now.
All right. I don't mean to embarrass you. I'm simply I want to make sure you're with us.
Yeah. Where is this Brown?
Providence, Rhode Island. It was the first Baptist college in this country. It was established by Moses Brown in 1700, I'm going to say 64, thereabouts. It's one of the Ivy League schools, with Dartmouth, Yale, Harvard, Princeton, Cornell, Pennsylvania, a couple of others there somewhere. It's one of the old pre 1776 universities. And at times it's had quite a Christian message among Baptists and non-Baptists in its early days. No question about evangelical outlook. Well, I didn't say it was today. I would be hastened to add that the Brown University would not be recognized by Moses Brown any more than Princeton would be recognized by the brave souls who founded Samuel Davies and Jonathan Edwards and William and Gilbert Tennant in the year of our Lord 1746. Which is the date of its founding, when they founded it as a theological seminary to train ministers for Christian churches, any more than be personal, any more than Wake Forest would be recognized by the people who founded it in 1833. Or John Harvey would recognize the Harvard which bears his name.
What was the denomination
started Wake Forest? A Southern Baptist Convention, North Carolina Convention. This is the way it is. Marvin?
As a society, things that didn't give and the people thinking things. Where are we as Christians going to go? I mean, we're against the wall, you know.
Sometimes I feel the wall pushing me on the back in sharp points. Whaley changes a little to address ourselves that question. Are you all right?
I'm
This is the purpose of this course, Marvin. I know you may be thinking, well, how will this help me in my ministry? It's not Greek exegesis, not New Testament, not Old Testament, not church history, not systematic theology. I agree with that. But this course should, in my prayerful hopes, arm you even more deftly to meet the people where they are, to apply the Word of God to them in their present straits and circumstances. When you're in the pulpit, you will have a congregation. I don't care whether it's Baptist, Presbyterian, Methodist, Episcopalian, which every weekday is struggling with the cults of the day, and with the humanism of the day, with the radicalism of the day, and they will be having young people who are being torn apart. And I meet parents all the time who are torn, literally torn apart by the influences working on their young people. Today, when I came in the Atlanta airport, I was in a hurry, but there was a new cult there, dressed in white, handing out flowers and handing out something. They stopped me. I didn't even look at it. But the girls were dressed in sort of chiffon white, cotton thing, rather prettily dressed, and the young men were dressed the same way. And I didn't, at the time, I sort of wished I had later, found out what cult it was, but I knew that you were waiting. I didn't want to hold you up because I know where you have to wait for me, and so I didn't do it. But maybe when I go back tomorrow, after you let me off, I'll see. Have you seen them down there at the airport? Oh, this is the first time I've seen them. Now, I don't know who they are, but the boy offered me some flowers, and I looked at him. He has, oh well, I mean, sort of a sickly, so nice smile, and handed the flowers up to me. As a girl, I was sort of holding out, you know, what have I got here, you know? And I wasn't just curious, but I just didn't stop.
Well, if you take the flowers, you got to give the money.
Well, I went about to take the flowers for several reasons. Mostly because I didn't know what to do if I did take them. That was not first, that was second. I was supposed to give them the tag, but I didn't want to give money to them. Unless I knew a lot about that cause, I wasn't going to give my money, the Lord's money, to some radical cause just because I got some flowers. But you see, I don't know what you'll be facing in the pulpit. I'm going to tell you something, you don't either. Because only when you get into a congregation do you realize the problems that are in that congregation. And as the people learn to have confidence in you, they will come to you and they will point out the points to you. I know because I've been in that position. And it's heart-rending. And you're going to have to be intellectually prepared, not just to present the word, but to present the word as an answer to their particular problems. Situational ethics, communism, existentialism, the Moonies, Hare Krishna, whatnot. And I don't know what sects will develop in the next 10 years, which will claim your attention. There's a never-ending number of them, and you're going to meet that. There's no way, if you're going to be a pastor to your people, preaching faithfully the word of God, be the need, the shepherd of souls, which is what you should be, you're going to have to meet these issues. There's no way to avoid it. This is not an extraneous course. This hits at the very heart of pastoral relationship.
I think something happened that we've probably lost a lot of
this is true. It's scriptural, and we must do it. But it's Jesus crucified who will meet, who provides the answer. But what when you say, "I believe in the resurrection of the dead"? What do you mean? What does the resurrection mean?
Well, it's a fall.
What does the? Well, I'm sure they don't. you ask the average adult, you ask the average adult coming out of a good evangelical church, what does the fall mean? What did the fall really mean? What does redemption really mean? Well, what does commitment to Christ mean? Now, I don't mean to say that any of us know all the aspects of that commitment. But as we grow in grace, we know. I was talking today. To be very frank, I was waiting for the plane at Birmingham Airport, and there's a policeman sitting as you go in where they check your baggage. He's a Christian man. I didn't know, but I had some time, and he just looked like a fine person. I just went over to him, and I forget what I asked him. Some innocuous question, and we got talking, and he said, "I'm a Christian." I said, "I am too," and we shook hands. And then he really started in, and he told me that there was a man he knew who had been bothered about his spiritual situation, and a policeman. And then he told me that they had a police prayer meeting that was instituted by the chief of police, and it meets in City Hall in the policeman's room there every Wednesday morning, and the men get up before going on duty, and they thrash out each other's problems, if there's sickness, death, or spiritual depression, and that this is the way they grow in grace. And you don't often expect to see a policeman. And when they called my plane, he came over and spoke to me, and gave me his name, and which was Mr. Tyler. And we just had a fine spiritual time, and we shook hands, and his replacement came there, and I guess the replacement stood there and looked at us and wondered what we were doing. Now, instead of accosting me for trying to get concealed weapons in, we were exchanging Christian greetings and so on, and he just stood there and looked at us, and this other fellow said, "I just made a friend," and I said, "Goodbye, Mr. Tyler," and went off and gone on. I had my seat, and that was the way we ended the thing. And you meet people this way who are growing in grace, and as we grow in grace, we, as I was saying to you today, things that didn't used to bother us. I mean, we become more conscious of our inadequacies, of the remnants of the old man that clings so tightly to us. You see, an unregenerate sinner, it doesn't bother him if he cheats. It doesn't bother him if he lies. It doesn't bother him if he steals. He doesn't want to get caught because he's got a prison sentence coming. Oh, he wants to escape the temporal consequences of his acts. Oh, even now some people do that so they get back in jail so they don't know how to cope with society. And they prefer life in jail, which is totally adding to my way of thinking to yours. Yeah, sure. They just built a new jail in Rowan County that has TV and wonderful assembly rooms, and it's better than the Holiday Inn.
And it's free.
And it's free. Hell of a type.
You get a bonus to get in.
Well, all the prisons want to be sent there and nowhere else. That's ridiculous, you know. But committing the crime doesn't really bother them. But you and I, as I was telling him, I can think of things that didn't used to bother me. But I began to look more at Christ, then I began to realize that things that used to bother me ought to bother me. And the same way, of course, as we begin to understand the mind of Christ, then we begin to see what we must do as pastors to shepherd the flock. I'm glad the accent is coming on shepherding the cycling. You just don't say to a man, "Accept Jesus Christ," and he believes, "Well, it's fine, come join us, brother," and let him go float. And it's a good way to drown. We need to shepherd and disciple the flock. And intellectually, sometimes we do it first. We do it when they're hard up, and that's fun. Don't misunderstand, but we should. The Briarwood Church, the brand which my daughters remember, has a marvel system of taking care of all sorts of situations. But they also don't forget the defense of faith. They shepherd there, too. Do you know that church? Do you ever fly into Birmingham?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's well worth knowing. David Jordan, one of our students here, came from that church. Now, have I been clear to you? This is the reason for the course. I don't want to belabor this issue, but I want you to know that it's not extraneous. It's not an intellectual extravagance that you're taking on the side to say, I've had apologetics. Use it! Now, well, who's next in the program? Let me see. Oh, yes. I remember the chapter.
Well, it's wrapping up that chapter.
Let's look at page 145 now. Page 145, he denied the biblical doctrine of good and evil. Let's look at that quote. The fundamental assumption, the old ethic, that's the Christian ethic, the much despised Puritan ethic, is that there's something essentially evil in human nature. He wrote this about 1890, 90 years ago. How utterly modern. Its whole purpose is to destroy this evil element. That's the old ethic. No other science is so wholly destructive, but all true science is essentially constructive. Where then is the fundamental fallacy which must lurk somewhere in the current of moral philosophy? It lies in the very assumption of evil propensity. They underlie the social world blown in the nature of man. They would never have been planted there if they had not been necessary to its development. They are evils only insofar as they conflict with individual social evils. In other words, there is no such thing as evil. Man outgrows. Thus, the social sciences are the only truly constructive science. If men would only accept this new ethic based on social science, they would come to new understand the purpose of life. They would understand that man's chief end is the satisfaction of his life, of his desire for happiness, and it is not to be found in our duty either to God or to our fellow men. On this, Ward was very clear. The world labors in a brave and serious area. It has generally been supposed our duties to our fellow men and to our Maker are more important than the mere acquisition of knowledge. This position, however sound it may seem, is as false in logic as it is pernicious in effect. Moral culture leads to abstract sophistry and invalidity. Religious culture, to the exclusion of intellectual training, degenerates into morbid asceticism or bigoted fanaticism. Neither serves to accelerate in the smallest degree. Why? The onward march of civilization. Thus, if you have an ethical system which says that man's greatest happiness is in his service to God, you are inhibiting social progress. In Franklin Roosevelt, he did. In Lyndon Johnson, he did. In John Kennedy, he did. And although Carter doesn't know it, in Carter he did. Now, let's look at derivatives. In 1881, 99 years ago, Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr., who was on the Supreme Court until his death in 1954, appointed by Roosevelt in 1904, Third Roosevelt, wrote a book, The Common Law. Now, I know that you can read it. I'm not reading this so to make sure you read it, but I want to exegete as we go along.
Where are you?
I'm on the middle of 146, John. Okay. The life of the law has not been logic, it has been experience. The felt necessity of the time, the prevalent moral and political theories, intuitions of public power, policy, avowed or unconscious, even the prejudice which the judges share with their fellow men may have a good deal more to do with the syllogism and determine the rules by which men should be governed. Now, the law embodies the story of the nation's development through many centuries. What does the law? the laws of the accumulated what? Social experience of the nation. There is no thus saith the Lord. Note, the substance of law at any time corresponds fairly well with what has been regarded as convenient by those making or interpreting. What then is the law? Convenience. But the form and the machinery and the degree to which it's able to work out desired results depends much upon its path. Now, what you have here is a Darwinian conception entering into the concept of law. That law is a product of evolutionary experience. Now, fortunately, when this was written in 1881, the Supreme Court of the nation was in the hands of men who vigorously rejected this idea. At this particular time of which we're speaking, the great jurist in the court was Stephen J. Field. Now, you don't probably remember him, but one of our good biographers has written a great biography of Stephen J. Field, who was the great defender of the court, the great defender of constitutional law from his appointment in 1862 by Abraham Lincoln until his death in 1895. For 33 years, he was the voice of the conscience on the court. Now, I do not mean to imply that there were not other men on the court who had a good conscience. I don't mean that. But of the jurists of that time, Field was the brilliant man who saw the issue. And he vigorously rejected this whole concept of law. You may not know it, but let me illustrate what I mean. During the war, there were Copperheads in the North, called in the North Copperheads, who were really Southern sympathizers. And one of these men, by the name of Milligan, was arrested by Abraham Lincoln under an executive order which created a military district in Ohio and Indiana and Illinois under General Burnside. After he had been disastrously defeated at the Battle of Fredericksburg, they got him out of the main line of fire to a place where they thought he couldn't do much harm. But Burnside fooled them. He issued a military order number 38, which gave him military command and created a military district where there was no war. That is in Indiana, Illinois, and Ohio. And he proceeded to arrest people right and left. And he arrested Mr. Milligan on the theory that he was a Confederate spy. And he had him tried by military court, which was distinctly illegal, because military courts could not be set up in peace where there was no congressional action for them and where there was no civil unrest, which was not, of course, in Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio were part of the Northern, there was no civil unrest there. But he arrested him. In the meantime, Lincoln died. And through a series of brilliant maneuvers, his lawyers were able to get the case transferred on appeal to the Supreme Court of the United States. And in the decision, which is known as Ex Parte Milligan, rendered by Stephen J. Field in 1866, Stephen J. Field gave forth a historic statement which you may not recognize, but the opening sentence of it runs like this: the Constitution stands in time of war as well as in time of peace. No more damnable doctrine was ever devised than that which says it is not an instrument which stands in time of war. And then he went on to explain that this is the way for, he didn't use the word totalitarian, but he did use the word absolute. This is the way for absolutism to come into government. This is the way to destroy the Constitution. And this is a historic decision. It was finally overturned, to a degree at least, by a case which some of you may remember, namely the Greenfield case in 1963. It wasn't the Greenfield family was put to death for allegedly spying for Russia in this country? What was the name? Greenberg.
Yeah.
Goldberg. Well, they were put to death. Now, although they did not openly repudiate the Stephen Field decision in 1866, they certainly weakened it by a court which was not worthy of the name. But until the Goldberg case, that decision stood for almost a century. Now, I mention this because Stephen J. Field was a man of great principle. Incidentally, here's the irony of the situation. Stephen J. Field had been a leading Democrat in California, but had worked for the election of Lincoln out of conviction. And Lincoln thought that he owed him a debt. And when the vacancy came on the court, he, through the death of Roger Taney, the Chief Justice, he put Stephen Field on the court, thinking that Field would uphold Lincoln's own violations of the Constitution, which were many. And he just sort of expected political support from Field. And from that moment on, when cases came up which were obviously contrary to the Constitution and obviously dangerous, Field gave opinions against Lincoln, and which annoyed Lincoln very much. It was sort of a case which accused Field being a dog that bit the hand that fed him, that which was not true. To begin with, Field didn't ask for a meal, and secondly, he had too much strength of character to bow to Lincoln's trying to win him over. I just say that in passing, but this, the seed was sown, and in 1904, Theodore Roosevelt appointed Oliver Wendell Holmes to the court of the United States in order to get Holmes to, shall we say, support his views. But the court did not, as a court, did not accept Oliver Wendell Holmes' concept of law. I would say probably the first case in which it became pretty obvious, this is a matter of strict opinion, not, I cannot be dogmatic. Some constitutional theorists would probably say Helbring versus Davis in 1937. And I would say that I can see how they would do that. I can sympathize with those who hold that position. But in my opinion, the court more openly voiced this concept of common law in West Coast Hotel versus Parrish. Now, that's opinion, and people would differ within that. That wouldn't bother me too much, because you could probably argue that both cases began to show up. But I think the West Coast Hotel Company versus Parrish probably reflects it more clearly than the Helbring versus Davis. In Helbring versus Davis, the court was caught by the tricky way in which an act had been drawn up so that it couldn't rule directly on the issue as it did in the West Coast case. I won't go into it more. The point is that gradually the evolutionary philosophy crept into the American system of jurisprudence. And to the federal courts. Although even here it had an even progress. Do any of you remember Judge Leonard Hand? Well, he was the senior judge of the New York Court of Appeals, Circuit Court, Federal Circuit Court in the state of New York, and he habitually gave tremendous decisions which were admired by the Supreme Court. There was a great deal of pressure from conservative Democrats and Republicans to have Roosevelt name him to the Supreme Court, a position for which he was eminently qualified. However, Roosevelt refused on the plea that you couldn't depend on him, which was true. You couldn't. Roosevelt didn't want anybody in the court who would rule against him. And from that point of view, there's no way you could depend on learned hand. If you want a judge who would decide cases in the light of the law, you could always depend on learned hand. Again, let me say, I don't know how many of you remember this, but in 1944, as a result of the OPA price rationing system, a case developed involving Sears Roebuck Company of Chicago. This was really a funny case. 43. Yes. This was it was the Office of Price Control and Rationing, and the government accused Sears Roebuck of violating the Rationing Control Act and the Pricing Act, and so they finally Sears Roebuck maintained a haughty silence and refused to answer the charges. They really were not guilty, but the Office of OPA seized the office of the president of Sears Roebuck, a man 66 years old, and he refused to get out of his chair, so they carried him in his chair out on Wabash Avenue in Chicago. Now, a Chicago Tribune reporter at the time, that was a very conservative paper at the time, happened to get wind of it, and as they brought him down the sidewalk, he took a picture of Mr. Avery Sewell, the president of Sears Roebuck, sitting in his chair and desk on the sidewalk in Wabash Avenue. It didn't go very well. Now, there's a very important case. This case came before the circuit court judge for Northern Illinois, and he ruled that the government was in error, that Sewell Avery should be carted back upstairs, and he gave a very, very caustic decision, which made the Department of Justice in Washington look very silly. Of course, it had already looked silly, but this judge added a few finishing touches. At the same time, something you may not know took place. You may remember that when Pearl Harbor came, the government rounded up all known Japanese of whether it was sins or not, and put them in prison confinement camps on the West Coast. And they did the same thing on the island of Hawaii. On the island of Hawaii, they happened to get a hold of a Japanese citizen whose patriotism was beyond question. And they put him in a military jail. And he got a hold of a good American lawyer who brought a writ of habeas corpus. And the lawyer was smart. Hawaii was not a state, you see. And he could, and since it was under military control, the lawyer could bring the suit in any court he wanted to, provided the Federal Circuit Court. And he brought it before the Federal Circuit Court in the city of Chicago of illegal detainment. And the same judge who had ruled against the government in the Sewell Avery, the Sears Roebuck case, had this case plunked on his desk. By this time, this federal judge was really up in arms, and somebody got wind of what the lawyer had done, and told the army they better get the commanding officer at Pearl Harbor off base fast. And the army sent in a bomber and put him down in Guam, beyond the jurisdiction of the circuit court in Chicago, because the same judge wrote a bristling attack, ordering the army to release the prisoner at once. He said, I mean now, I don't mean tomorrow. And he also sent the order to hold the army commander and hold Pearl Harbor in contempt of the circuit court at Chicago. And this is what got the army going. They took that man out so fast, he didn't have time to take his family. They whisked him down and put him down in Guam, where he was beyond the reach of the federal court at Chicago. Now, this sort of thing was kept from the public for obvious reasons, except the Chicago Tribune did leak the Sewell Avery case when it published that picture of a man almost 70 years of old being carted down the steps and out in the sidewalk. It was ridiculous. Now, this judge is gone. He's dead. And I suppose there are some judges who reflect the same old traditional basic philosophy, but you talk to the average judge today on the federal bench, and he is soaking of Darwinism, the mutability of law, the relativism in law, that the law is simply to the moment, and what is socially acceptable versus what is socially non-acceptable.
You know, something happened just recently that a decision came out of the Supreme Court that said, and this is a common law practice, it's going back ever since common law has been in existence, that a wife cannot, or a spouse, husband and wife, cannot testify
against
their wife. And they said, that doesn't mean anything now because obviously the marriage didn't mean much.
Yeah, I should have brought that up. This decision, which allows a wife to test against her husband, I have studied, and you may know I gave testimony in a court case last year about common law and biblical antecedents before the Kentucky State Supreme Court. This law goes back beyond the earliest days of English common law, back beyond the Magna Carta, back beyond the earlier English common law, even of the Anglo-Saxons before the Norman Conquest. And it goes back, now I'm not saying it's absolutely written in the scripture, but it goes back to biblical time. And with a few sentences, the Supreme Court overthrew it. Which based upon the supposition that, see, marriage is no longer a sacred binding contract within the bounds of the covenant of redemption, which I believe, I'm sure that you believe. And thus, marriage, therefore, is a matter of convenience. Oh, it involves some sort of a contract, but the contract can be rescinded. And since it's, what?
Anytime.
At any time. And since the contract can be rescinded, you cannot apply to modern marriage relationship the time-honored point of view that the wife cannot testify against her husband.
Women are even retaining their maiden name.
Oh, yes. That's part of the liberation movement.
They're combining the married name with the maiden name.
Mm-hmm.
Or not even taking them.
Or not even. They do both, yeah.
Which shows the lack of commitment.
Now, if I were passing a church and a couple came before me, and the lady insisted that she be that clergy, I would not perform the ceremony.
Would you perform it with a Christian and a non-Christian?
No, I would not.
Would you perform it for non-Christian?
Not in a church. Now, this is another question. In fact, my own pastor brought this question up the other day. Since a pastor in North Carolina and Georgia both derives his power to perform marriage not only from the church in which he's ordained, but from the state law in which he lives, you might conceivably argue that if it was not a religious ceremony, and if it was not performed in a church, that acting under civil law of the state, which it permits marriage that kind, I say you might conceivably argue that it might be all right. Now, he and I talked about this at length because this situation actually came up. And I said, well, I said probably under common law and the law of the state of North Carolina, you might be able to substantiate that action. But I said, Joe, I said, from my own personal position, if I were in your position, I would not do it.